time for us to end this hierarchy of who has the right to live, who deserves not to suffer.
As an indigenous person, the fur trade represents so much more to me than just animal abuse. It represents cultural genocide.
That is pretty summarized. There were 6 or 8 in the raiding party.
It was racist, but we did not know about terrible.
These kinds of actions are going to be more and more frequent.
Every laboratory we can help from information from inside the lab and someone who works there. We could have been the animal's brain.
But they found the animal's crippled head, unable to use their arms and legs. No food or medical care. Broken bones. Fingers and nails torn off.
14 of the 2 dozen protesters.
Good morning. Welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM.
We have a packed show, so we just got ourselves
exactly.
On
we thought, let's get on with this introduction and let's go. Let me introduce myself first. I'm Rob Moore here with Lauren Corman. Hello, Lauren.
Hello.
And Carl.
I'm not actually here.
Carl Orzechowski.
And Lamia Gibson, teching as always. I think it's Lamia's 2-week anniversary with not smoking.
It's true.
How's it going?
It's good. I'm even off the patch.
Excellent.
And I stopped being angry. Quite so much.
We're very happy to hear that.
Yeah.
On today's show, later in the show, we're going to hear from best-selling author Jeffrey Moussaïef Masson. He's going to talk about the emotional lives of turkeys. It's Canadian Thanksgiving coming up this weekend. So we thought we'd talk about turkeys and do they have an emotional life? Well, stay tuned to find out. And after that, we'll talk about freeganism with Adam Weissman of the Wetlands Preserve. Do you want to say a little bit about that?
Well, I thought that it would be kind of interesting to have Adam on to talk about freeganism because Thanksgiving is a time of, for a lot of people anyway, a time of extreme excess and abundance. And I think for a lot of vegans, we want to create a sense of abundance so people will think that, you know, veganism isn't about denial and scarcity. But on the other hand of that, I wonder about our consumption practices. So I thought maybe Thanksgiving would be a good time to reflect on veganism and consumption. So that's why we're going to have Adam on today.
I think that's awesome. Going to help us out with the news, though, right now is Richard O'Berry, marine mammal specialist with One Voice France, former trainer of Flipper. We had Richard on August 30th. His interview is online, as well as Sakaya Hemi talking about the international protest of Japan's dolphin slaughter taking place this Saturday, October 8th. And Richard is here to remind us all about what's happening with that. Richard, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you. Glad to be back in Canada.
Tell us about October 8th and why you want people to show up to protest Japan's dolphin hunt.
Well, this is indeed the largest deliberate slaughter of dolphins in the world, and we feel very strongly that we can stop it if we can get enough opposition. The only reason it goes on is there's no opposition. So if all of your listeners would just give us 2 hours of their time on Saturday and show up, that will have repercussions in Tokyo. Tokyo is monitoring this, and if they get enough people showing up, we could affect the permitting process. You know, the fishermen kill these dolphins, 20,000 a year. They've killed hundreds of thousands of them in the last 20 years because they have a permit to do so. And so the problem is in Taiji, Japan, but the solution is in Tokyo. So if you protest in Toronto, Paris, London, New York, Washington, so forth and so on, that has an impact in Tokyo. Someone has to do damage control for them, and eventually they'll have a meeting and say, look, this is not worth it. You know, people are not coming to Japan anymore. So please show up for a couple of hours and get the information from your radio station or Zoo Check Canada, helping coordinate the effort up there.
And you don't expect just animal rights activists to show up for these protests, right?
No, that's so important. Glad you brought that up, because they expect the animal welfare industry too, because that's what they do. They expect them to do that. We need regular people, school children, rock and roll bands, pizza shops, anybody, everybody, people who are opposed to this most brutal slaughter in the world of dolphins, to just show up and voice their opposition in a peaceful, respectful way.
Richard, for maybe people who hadn't got a chance to listen to our program on the slaughter of dolphins in Japan, can you just give us a little bit of a briefing about why this is an important issue?
It's an important issue because, again, the largest deliberate slaughter of dolphins is going on this planet. And genocide is taking place I believe. I can't prove that other than the meetings we had at the mayor's office in Taiji when we asked the fishermen if we could subsidize them, pay them not to go out. They translated that around the table and it came back. This is not about money. This is about pest control. They see the dolphins as competition eating fish, and they want those fish for themselves. And they'll kill every dolphin that they can because the dolphin eats 30, 50, some of them eat 100 pounds of fish every day. And that's what they're trying to do is kill them all. By the way, some people suggested they didn't want to protest because they're putting people out of jobs. That's not the case here. These people in Taiji are not poor. In fact, they're very rich. They all have very nice houses, brand new cars, new motorbikes, beautiful new boats. And we asked some of the younger fishermen what would happen if they didn't get a permit from Tokyo. They said they hoped that happened, that they would go out and fish for something else. So, you see, it's not black and white because, you know, a lot of our vegan friends are listening and going, well, doesn't the fish have just as much right as the dolphin? And they're going to fish for something else. Well, that's true. But we all have to draw the line somewhere, and they are going to fish. And so we're hoping that they will stop killing the dolphins and find another way to make a living.
But if they're saying that they're hoping to get this permit taken away so they'll do something else, if they want to do something else, why aren't they doing something else?
Well, I'm talking about a very small minority of the younger fishermen. They say the older guys keep this thing going. And so they would rather, some of them were dolphin trainers. One of the guys I talked to through an interpreter said he was at the IMATA, that's the International Marine Animal Trainers Association conference in Las Vegas. And he knows what dolphins are. I don't believe most Japanese people really know that dolphins are more like gorillas or humans in that they are self-aware. They can look into a mirror and they know what they're looking at. And they can anticipate what's going to happen to them and to their offspring in this brutal scenario in the killing lagoon in Taiji. And as a matter of fact, it just started on the 1st of October. So the killing is going on today as we're speaking on the telephone. They go out in 13 boats. They drive the dolphins into this lagoon, and they massacre them in the most brutal way imaginable. The Japanese character for whale, kujira, translates into monster fish. And the same is true with the dolphin. I forgot the name for dolphin at the moment, but it really translates into fish. And they really think that it's a cold-blooded fish and not a warm-blooded, air-breathing mammal with a brain larger than the human brain.
Mm.
So that's, I believe, part of the problem.
And for anyone out there who wants more info, we've got a bunch of links up on our site, animalvoices.ca, about details about the dolphin hunt, as well as where you can go to your nearest city to protest this Saturday, October 8th. And as well, we have Rick's other interview, as well as Saki Yahemi speaking directly from Japan, archived on our website. Rick, thanks so much for being with us, and good luck with the protest.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks, Richard.
All right, well, that was the first item up on the news today, and I just thought it'd be great to have Richard back to brief us on the details about that, since he's been working so hard to organize that international protest, set to be the largest international protest that I'm aware of for quite some time. And now moving on with some other news, the Federal Trade Commission has announced that the United Egg Producers Animal Care Certified logo will no longer be stamped on egg cartons in the United States. This decision ends the egg industry's 3-year national advertising campaign that misled consumers concerned about animal cruelty. The Animal Care Certified logo first came under scrutiny in June 2003 when Compassion Over Killing filed petitions with the Better Business Bureau and the FTC, as well as other federal agencies, asserting that the logo is misleading. Under the Animal Care Certified guidelines, egg producers are permitted to intensively confine hens in battery cages so small they can't even spread their wings, among other abuses. In 2003, and again upon appeal in 2004, the BBB deemed the Animal Care Certified logo misleading because it implied a greater level of humane care than is actually the case. According to the FTC, by March 31, 2006, the Animal Care Certified logo will be gone from grocery store shelves, and consumers can expect to find it replaced with an alternative logo reading United Egg Producers Certified. This victory is important both for animals and consumers, explained COK Executive Director Erica Meyer. While the egg industry's husbandry guidelines still permit routine animal cruelty, at least the new logo will no longer convey a false message of humane animal care. The industry's next step should be to amend its guidelines to prohibit battery cages. That was from Yahoo.com. Next, from Jerusalem Post, Israel will put an end to the force feeding of geese for culinary purposes following Agriculture Minister Yisrael Katz's withdrawal of a proposal to the cabinet Sunday that would have made the practice lawful. In August 2003, the High Court agreed with a petition by NOAA, an umbrella organization for animal rights organizations in Israel, that force feeding geese for the production of foie gras causes unnecessary suffering. Someone should tell Jack Layton that, if you happen to hear our interview, our show a couple of weeks ago. The court ruled that foie gras production violated the Protection of Animals Law 1994, which prohibits torture, cruelty, or abuse to animals. Katz's proposal would have sought legislation to effectively bypass the high court ban in an attempt to save the livelihood of some 600 families who make their living from the production of the delicacy. The cabinet Sunday established a committee to recommend alternative employment and compensation payments within 60 days for those employed in this sector. Foie gras producers force feed newborn geese with high caloric food by inserting a tube into the esophagus, resulting in the swelling of the liver. The process lasts about 3 months, after which the geese, who have a life expectancy of about 60 years in their natural habitat, are slaughtered. 60 years, I had no idea. And a couple things to mention locally in Toronto this weekend is the Helping Animals 101 conference put on by the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Visit www.helpinganimals101.com for more info on that. Also, the Toronto Vegetarian Association, the largest vegetarian association in North America, will be celebrating its 60th anniversary with a fundraising gala on October 7th. The largest veg association in North America. It's pretty impressive.
I mean, people come all over the world to the Vegetarian Food Fair every year. Mm-hmm. It's huge.
Yeah, I think it's pretty great.
You're even wearing your TVA shirt today.
I'm actually wearing my TVA shirt today in honor of it. We're going to go right into our interview with Jeffrey Moustayef-Masson, talking about the emotional lives of turkeys. Of course, turkeys will be gracing the dinner tables of millions of homes this weekend. And I wanted to mention Cynica Crossland, a well-known Canadian activist. She sent out the following Canadian Food Inspection Agency's turkey slaughter stats for the calendar year 2004 over a listserv that I got, and I just wanted to mention this. Young turkeys, 18,505,758 slaughtered, 238,654 condemned, 28,849 found dead on arrival. Mature turkeys, 866,710 slaughtered, 43,087 condemned, and 2,511 found dead on arrival. Now to talk about the emotional lives of turkeys and why they should not be found on our dinner plates this Thanksgiving is the well-renowned Jeffrey Moustayef-Masson, author of such books as When Elephants Weep and The Pig Who Sang to the Moon, The Emotional Lives of Farm Animals. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Now, turkeys, in your book you explore the emotional lives of farm animals. Does a turkey have an emotional life?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Again, as with pigs, it's hard for people to recognize that because most people don't have close relationships with turkeys. So what I tell everybody is you've got to read two books. The first book is by Karen Davis called More Than a Meal. And it's an extraordinary history of turkeys and talks in great detail about their affection and what they're capable of. And equally fascinating is a book called Illumination in the Flatwoods, A Season with the Wild Turkey by a man called Joe Hutto, who's a biologist who is not at all an animal rights person, but he lived with these wild turkeys, and it is just extraordinary what these animals are capable of. I give some of the stories in my Pig Who Sang to the Moon, but those are two books I would definitely recommend that everybody should have on their bookshelf.
Could you share a story with us now?
Well, one of the things I was just remembering, what Joe Hutto talked about, was the turkeys kind of accepted that he was there when they hatched, so they imprinted on him, and they saw him as a turkey. So they included him in everything, and he said he never had better companionship, and he learned so much during that year that he would never have learned on his own. But one of the things that struck me, one of the stories that I found absolutely adorable, was how these
turkeys communicate with one another. You know, they make all kinds of sounds, and he was trying to learn how to sound like a turkey. And one of the things that he learned to do was to make the sound of warning, predator. Very important for a turkey to be able to warn other turkeys, uh-oh, you know, there's a hawk overhead, or there's trouble brewing, or let's get out of here. So, and they're particularly frightened of snakes. So one day, he was learning to make the sound that warns snake, and all the turkeys would rush away. So one day he turned over a log, and there were some baby rattlers there. So he did his sound, you know, whatever it is that he does. And I think there were like 12 of them, and they came running over. And they looked at these little snakes, and they turned their heads, and they looked at him in puzzlement like, are you nuts? You know, these aren't dangerous. These are baby snakes. And he said he was so embarrassed. You know, he'd lost prestige. He'd lost face to the.
We can take those snakes with one wing tied behind our backs.
That's right. Yeah, but he said the way they just, you know, they all turned like one face and looked at him like, what's the matter with you? Get a grip.
Well, you know, turkeys are often seen as, you know, dim-witted, and people will even call each other, oh, you turkey.
That's right.
You know, do they have an intelligence to speak of?
Oh, absolutely. Now, remember that all of these animals are very different when we domesticate them, and further when we keep them under horrendous conditions. So a wild turkey is not the same thing as a domestic turkey. I mean, they're the same animal, of course, but it's, you know, it's like if you took a human being and you put him in prison or solitary confinement or some horrible condition for years and years and years, then you came to him and you wanted to have an interview about what are humans like. I mean, you wouldn't get an absolutely reliable indication of the talents of humans if you're only looking at people in a prison population, and that's the case with turkeys. And it goes further than that, because at least in a prison, they don't try and transform you physically. But we've transformed the turkey. We've made them so huge now that many of them can't even mate any longer. They require artificial insemination because the male bird is so big that he can't even mount the female. So what happens to the emotions of an animal and to the natural abilities of an animal that's raised in this way? Nobody's investigated that in great detail, but it's just common sense to realize that you're going to have a lot of problems with these animals. And I think that's why turkeys are sometimes seen to be the way they are. But wild turkeys are very different animals. And that's the way every turkey should be, like a wild turkey. And wild turkey are extremely intelligent birds.
And evidenced by their calls about predators?
You have the calls of predators. I mean, there are just so many things that wild turkeys are capable of doing that we didn't even imagine because we've never looked at it. And that's, you know, Joe Hutto goes into great detail about that. And, of course, you know, as I tried to explain earlier in an earlier interview with you, every animal is as intelligent as it needs to be in its own environment. And the wild turkey lives a very precarious existence in the wild, not nearly as precarious as with us, but, I mean, they do have to avoid dangers, and they learn how to do it. They learn from one another. They have traditions where they learn from their mother. They're gregarious and social birds, so they're constantly reinforcing one another. I mean, really, they're capable of quite extraordinary feats. I urge you to look at those two books to find out in detail.
You know, some people might say, well, turkeys don't really care if they're on a factory farm or not. You know, it's not that they don't want to be there. It's that they don't know anything else. They're not exactly suffering. What would you say to that?
Well, you know, obviously there's some truth in that, but it's a kind of perverse truth because it would also be true of a human. I mean, if you were to raise, and by the way, this is exactly the argument. I remember I lived in India for many years, and I used to get in these terrible arguments sometimes with arrogant Westerners who would come there, and they would make these extraordinary statements like, oh, you shouldn't feel sorry for these poor people. Yes, they're very poor, but they've never known anything but poverty, so they don't suffer. And I'd say, wait a minute, they suffer exactly the same way you and I would suffer. Just the mere fact that they don't know, that they've never known good health, doesn't mean that it doesn't hurt them to have a separating wound on their leg or to be hungry all the time. I mean, we evolved to feel these things equally, all of us. And there's no doubt that a domestic turkey and a wild turkey have the same feelings. So the fact that they don't know any better just means that, you know, we can't see it. We can't, and so much of their suffering is silent. I mean, first of all, remember that many animals evolved to suffer in silence for a very simple reason, that if they cry or call out, nobody's going to help them.
And they'll actually advertise for predators, actually.
But exactly.
Yeah.
So they learn to be silent. I mean, you see this with lambs, you see this with cows, and even Darwin was tricked into thinking, oh, well, you know, cows don't really suffer, they don't make any noise. Well, they don't make any noise because they don't dare to make any noise. And an animal that does dare, that can expect help, like a pig, a wild pig, when it's hurt, screams, especially the babies, because they're calling the adults over. And a mature male wild boar with huge tusks is a very formidable opponent, even for an elephant. Everything stays clear of that. So if those little babies call for help and suddenly a male boar is there, whoever the predator is going to leave really fast. But that's not true of a turkey, you see.
So how would they experience life on a factory farm? Is there something evident in their behavior?
I would say that, you know, one of the most common experiences of any animal on a farm is a form of depression. That is, it's created by boredom. And, you know, when humans get very bored, you get depressed. And I think that's exactly what happens to most factory farmed animals. They go into a kind of lethargic state where they don't react any longer. It's a sort of a subclinical learned helplessness. That is, they know that there's nothing they can do that's going to get them out of this situation. And therefore, there's no hope in the world. And they often become very passive. They give up. And they look like, and then we look at them and say, well, look at that bird. You know, it's not doing anything. We don't see it as a form of unhappiness. We see it as a form of dullness. The bird's not dull. I mean, no wild turkey looks dull. They're constantly on the move. They're constantly doing things. They're constantly searching for food and entertaining one another and doing the things that all sociable creatures do. And then we confine them into these tiny little cages or these small areas, and, of course, they give up and they become depressed.
I think I've read about turkeys or chickens that, you know, when they're in a small cage, I've read that some will actually just sort of rub themselves against the cage just sort of mindlessly, and they'll actually be bleeding from the cage, but they'll just keep doing it as if, you know, to liken to a human, as if a human's going crazy.
That's absolutely correct, and I think it's also, you know, anything, to feel anything is better than feeling nothing. And it's interesting you should make that that comment, because I feel that one could make an interesting analogy between children or adolescents, really, who cut themselves and animals who hurt themselves deliberately. And what we've found, I say we because I used to be in that field when I was a psychoanalyst in Toronto, what has been discovered is that these are often abused children. And I remember one girl in particular put it so starkly that I never forgot it. She said, well, nobody can ever claim that this didn't happen. What she meant was that people had denied for years that she was being abused by her father. And when she cut herself, which is a direct result of that sexual abuse, she was saying, now I have the wounds to prove it. Nobody can tell me it's all in your mind. I mean, it's a perverse and horrible logic, but I do understand the feelings behind that. And I wouldn't be surprised if turkeys and chickens do the same thing. You know, that life is not worth living for me under these circumstances. I may as well do something that makes me feel something.
Wow, that's fascinating yet really horrible at the same time.
It is horrible.
Yeah. Some people might say that if turkeys aren't there for us to eat, what good are they?
Well, just as good as humans. What good are we? You know, I mean, everything is in its own place in nature. And, of course, as we now know, you know, they sometimes call it the butterfly effect, which is a nice little ring to it. But the truth is that almost any animal you remove from its ecological niche is going to affect every other animal. You see that more and more. I mean, that's become now almost a cliche of conservation ecology, that we cannot remove. I mean, you can't even remove a mosquito without affecting other things. You know, there are certain birds that feed on mosquitoes. You take away the mosquitoes, those birds die. When those birds die, then other animals that depend on those birds die. And, you know, there's a chain effect here that has a very serious long-term effect on the entire planet. And that, you know, that's what we're learning, unfortunately, a little bit too late, that we can't just take something out of its environment and expect everything to be the same. So I think turkeys obviously serve a function when they are wild. Now, what we would do with all these domesticated turkeys, I don't know, but there are people that live with them, like Karen Davies, who said they make wonderful companions. And in fact, when I was visiting a farm sanctuary in California, I was holding a wild turkey who had the most beautiful colors on her head, or it was a male, I think, that I had ever seen, these bright blue and magenta and purple, and just an extraordinary thing just to hold this silky animal and realize it didn't mind being held because it knew that I meant it no harm. You know, nobody in the sanctuary hurts them, and they become remarkably friendly, just, you know, just the way a parrot does or any other bird that we become close to.
They're good in that it is good to be a turkey, I guess.
It's a very good, if you're a turkey, there's nothing more wonderful than to be a turkey. And that means being allowed to be a turkey, to do the things that turkeys do. And no animal on a farm is ever allowed to express its own nature. And that's the problem. That's, I think, even worse than slaughtering them. Well, I suppose that's the ultimate evil, because you deprive them of any ability to be themselves. But the way that we curtail their expression of their own being seems to me a great sin against nature.
Indeed. Jeff, thanks so much for sharing your insights with us.
Wonderful. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Animal Voices, 89.5 CIUT. This is Lamia, your friendly neighborhood technician, letting you know we're going to go to a couple ads, play a song, and then we'll be back with Lauren and Adam Weissman.
Hello, and welcome back to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman. Rob Moore just took off to learn some aerobics-related stuff than he does. He's learning a new technique. Rob teaches aerobics for people who want to hear a little bit of background on our co-host. Maybe before we jump into our interview with Adam, I'll get Carl to tell us about what we just heard.
That was a band from Vancouver, BC, Canada. They're still on tour right now, so if you hear about them coming to your town, you should check them out. They're called You Say Party, We Say Die. And that track was called Rise. I saw them in Toronto last week, and it was awesome.
And you did an interview with them as well.
Yes, I did.
And when is that going to be on your website?
It'll be on my website eventually, whenever I get around to typing it out.
I'm going
to
plug your website just for people to check out what you do. Carl is a vegan. He's also interested, obviously, in lots of other social justice issues and arts and music-related material. His website is everyoneisdoomed.com. You got to say it that way. We're going to go to an interview with Adam Weissman coming up in a couple minutes, but I wanted to plug the Animal Voices website as well, animalvoices.ca. We have a bunch of archives on that website. I think over 100 interviews at this point. So if you missed part of our program, or if you've heard about a past program that you wanted to check out, chances are it's on our website. So it's animalvoices.ca. Neil Harvey, who has been involved with the program now for a while, he has recently put a new feature on the website, which lets you look at all the different places around the world that Animal Voices has talked to people. And you can go and check out the Global Animal Voices map and click on any of the points and then find out where we interviewed people. So, for example, if you clicked on Brazil, you would see that we had just interviewed Marley Winkler, and you can find out more about the interview there. We're having a hard time getting a hold of Adam, so we're going to wait, see if he calls in, and then we're going to open up the phone lines to our lovely listeners. And we wanted to talk about, since we can't have Adam on, we wanted to talk about how vegetarians and vegans who are listening, how you do or do not celebrate Thanksgiving. So if you have some ideas about favorite dishes or why you choose to boycott this particular holiday, give us a call, 416-946-7000.
That's right.
So we have we have Carl here, and we have Lamia here. Unfortunately, we were going to be talking about consumerism and its relationship to the vegan diet, which is often seen as kind of this elitist diet. And then freeganism comes along and says, no, there's lots of ways that you can be vegan that doesn't have to do with buying expensive overpackaged items. And Adam was going to be talking about that. But unfortunately, we don't have him on the air. So next week, we're going to be doing a show on globalization and factory farming, and we'll get him on. I really hope. Anyway.
Very cool. I'm keeping my eye on the phone, but nothing's lighting up. But if listeners, if you want to call in too and talk about Thanksgiving and consumerism, possibly about boycotting Thanksgiving, or about finding out the truth about what the day is all about in regards to colonization, please call 416-946-7000.
There's also Carl's friend Ray has recently gone vegan, and his parents have been putting a lot of pressure on him to make sure that he is nutritionally sound, eating a nutritionally sound diet, and I'm kind of worried about Ray as he moves into Thanksgiving. Because it's a time when people really come together around food. And so we equipped him, hopefully, with a recipe that will please everybody. So if people have ideas about new vegans, what to do when you go home, if you go home to celebrate Thanksgiving, ideas about advice you would give to someone who's recently gone vegetarian or vegan, do give us a call, 416-946-7000.
Ray is probably listening right now as well.
He's going to be making the fabulous carrot millet pie.
Yeah. Oh, carrot millet pie for dinner.
Yeah. I'm still waiting here from Adam.
But we could talk about consumerism and Thanksgiving. What do you guys do for Thanksgiving? How do you minimize the impact on the planet?
Well, because my sisters are usually either out of the country or in a different city, we don't always celebrate Thanksgiving. But when we do celebrate Thanksgiving, it's fairly... I don't know. It's fairly low-key, I would say. I mean, yeah, there's tons of food, of course, and obviously a turkey, which others partake in. But, yeah, I wouldn't say it's too over-consumptive.
And your parents are Polish, too,
yes.
And so is Thanksgiving meaningful for them, do you think, in the same way that people who were born in Canada feel towards it, or at least some people do?
I don't know. I think Thanksgiving's kind of a strange holiday in that sense because it's kind of a colonial holiday, but also not really. Like, it can be tied to all sorts of harvest kind of celebrations. So I don't know if Canadians would feel more attached to it than others.
We just had someone call in. It wasn't Adam, but... Interesting question. He was saying that we're using the terms vegan and vegetarian, and he said for someone who doesn't know the difference between the two, could we please define them? Because he is confused, I guess. Or not confused, but just doesn't know.
Sure. Yeah, it's interesting because we definitely use the word on air a lot. Vegan there's lots of debate about what exactly it means, but generally if you look in a dictionary, vegan is someone who doesn't consume any animal product. So unlike a vegetarian who might consume eggs and dairy products, a vegan wouldn't have any of those products, nothing derived from an animal. So that would include, you know, milk and meat and eggs and animal derived products as well. Well, like gelatin, for example. And also, veganism tends to be more broadly defined than vegetarianism. For a lot of people who are vegan, they'll also often try to get rid of animal products in their wardrobe or to be cognizant of animal products in their personal care items, such as shampoo, and making sure that things like that aren't tested on animals. So veganism tends to be a bit stricter. For some cultures, vegetarianism and veganism are the same thing. It just means not eating any animal products. So I think it depends kind of where you're culturally positioned, but most of the time vegan just means no animal products.
And what about freegan?
Vegan is also a matter of a lot of debate exactly what that definition means. Yeah, it's a good question because we haven't really defined what veganism is. Veganism generally refers to people who are vegan most of the time, but if they come across or if they find something that is free, that isn't vegan, that they will also consume that. So it's a way of kind of... they're sort of scavengers of Western society, I would say. A lot of freegans consider themselves as making a statement about overconsumption and overpackaging and waste in Western society. So sometimes people will practice their freeganism by, you know, dumpster diving and finding food that's still good but that has been left out or is past some kind of arbitrary date. So some of the debates in the vegan and animal rights communities around veganism is people worry that it's maybe a bit too vague of a definition and it kind of gives people license to eat animals, or people will sometimes call themselves a vegan and they'll go home and eat a turkey or something like that and they'll say, well, it was free, right? My parents made it for me. So this is what veganism is. So people sometimes worry that it kind of waters down the definitions of veganism.
Mm-hmm. I think it can potentially help us grow, too.
Yeah.
Because lots of time it's like about, like you said, being scavengers, using things that have been thrown away that are still useful, like food that gets thrown away that's still useful. I think it's brilliant.
On the website that we were going to be referring to that Adam has been so heavily involved with, freegan.info, there's lots of pictures you can find of things that people have found in dumpsters, including, you know, full pizzas and beer and everything else that people throw away. It's pretty amazing. We wanted to get people to call in and talk about how they navigate Thanksgiving. If you have ideas for people who are maybe going home for Thanksgiving and are recent vegetarians or vegans, or how you feel about this particular holiday, give us a call, 416-946-7000. Again, it's 416-946-7000. We'd love to hear your thoughts on Thanksgiving and turkeys and what you do to navigate the holiday.
We have somebody on the phone line. Hello, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Oh, great.
And what's your name?
Carl.
Carl. Meet Carl.
Oh, how you doing?
Hello.
So what did you want to say about Thanksgiving, la la la, vegans? How do you deal?
Actually, I find it's a catch-22 because I really do try, but I find in some form there's always a celebration going on where there's everything that I'm kind of trying to stay away from. It's all there.
Mm-hmm.
So I really find it's like a balancing act, but you really have to. I think it's one of the most trying periods of the year to really focus and try to get your... discipline in check,
because
I do find that it is a challenge a lot of times when I say I'm not going to eat certain things or I'll try not to, and it's all right there.
Right.
Like it's everywhere, basically.
So this is like when you go home to see your family, or is this, where are the expectations? Yeah.
Everywhere. It's like friends, family. Yeah, I just find it's hard to, unless you really do disconnect and just say, okay, forget about it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which basically means you're staying away from family or staying away, I find it's not really tempting, I just find just the concept of it, I would like to just not really be around. Because I find, like, give thanks every day, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, when you do give thanks every day, you do find when you go to eat, every meal kind of does feel like Thanksgiving. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The one day we choose to celebrate Thanksgiving really does feel, and you can experience it a lot more often when you do give thanks a lot more. So it's kind of ironic that the one day is chosen for it, and the way it's celebrated, and I don't want to, like, disrespect it too much, but I just feel that I don't like how, like, what it stands for, because I think when you go back, which I think you should, I think Animal Voices should give people a history on, like, the true meaning of it.
You mean that we are supposed to be thanking the people who were originally here for handing over their land, which is a cross?
Exactly, exactly. And then basically let people really see that what we think we're celebrating is...
slaughter.
Yeah, that's, I don't know,
yeah,
man. I'm not really into that. I'm not
no
really
way.
A big fan of that. So
Carl,
I'm sure a lot of people wouldn't be.
How do you get around these... how do you navigate these situations? Like, do you bring your own food? Do you just eat certain things? Like, how would you deal with a situation like that?
I find sometimes it's easy just to, like, ask for what I want. Like, if I would rather have something, I really do say, well, in most cases, I'll be asked if I want to bring something or if I would like anything special. And I just usually say, hey. But I find I don't like being too picky. So I know we're not allowed to swear, right?
No.
But I find that factor of when you're being a little too picky sometimes, I find I don't like to like exercise that too much, but I will ask. Like if somebody says, hey, would I prefer this, or that? I'll say, well, how about adding another option? And that's the option I would like. You know what I mean?
Carl, I think we're going to try to get maybe some other voices on the line if we can. It was great to hear from you. I definitely hear what you're saying about being picky, too. It's always a fine line to walk. I think that vegans get to be seen as being really anal about a lot of things. And Herbivore magazine has recently put out a button that says cranky vegan asshole. And it's kind of about, you know, trying to embrace your inner assholes. You're kind of being, you know, you're in a position where you don't want to make people uncomfortable, but you also want to stand by your ethics. And how do we do that in a way? It's really difficult, but thanks for calling in.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Carl.
Thank you.
I just want to, in the last 5 minutes, want to make sure if anybody else has been trying to get through. The number is 416-946-7000. Again, 416-946-7000. We'd love to hear your thoughts on how you negotiate Thanksgiving or what the holiday means to you if you choose to boycott, and also what you think about veganism and consumption. A lot of people, as they're transitioning to a vegan diet, so one without animal products, will often buy really overpackaged, you know, goods, you know, the fake veggie burgers, you know, wrapped in like 20 layers of plastic, etc. And some people question whether or not this is really what we want to embody when we embrace the vegan diet. We have somebody else on the line?
We have somebody else on the line. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good, good. And what's your name?
Greg.
Greg.
So what are your thoughts, Greg, about Thanksgiving?
Okay, I'll give you a little bit of background. Originally from the West Coast, my wife and I have two girls. They're 15 and 13. They've been vegetarian since birth. And we take the emphasis off the main course idea of a Thanksgiving dinner, and we just have all kinds of wonderful vegetarian dishes. And in reference to your last caller, he's worried about offending people, sounding a little bit finicky, when I think too much emphasis is put on pleasing the palate of the Western taste, and basing everything around a main course and the accompanying dishes type of philosophy, when in actual fact you can have a wonderful Thanksgiving dinner and never even think about turkeys or main courses as such, and by the same token you can have a library of cookbooks and find all kinds of wonderful things that you can call main courses or major courses that you use as a center for the dinner. But I mean, it's like mind control, it almost sounds like, in the society where we all have to buy a Hallmark card on a certain day of the year, and we all have to sit around a table and talk about a certain concept, and a lot of times, as in this case, it's based on an absolute crock, as one of your moderators said. You know, the whole holiday is based on, you know, a crock. It's not even real.
Greg, I wanted to ask you some specifics, because you're talking about some of the lovely dishes that you prepare. I think for a lot of people, they're just not sure what vegans eat, let alone what a vegan would eat on a Thanksgiving. What are some of the specific things that you serve to your family?
Well, you can make a wonderful yam dish with cranberries. You can pull out the Moosewood Cookbook, and you can find many wonderful dishes in that. And there are myriad vegetarian cookbooks nowadays. There's another dish that does have dairy in it, but you can use cheese that doesn't have rennet. You know, it uses a coagulating enzyme rather than rennet to make the cheese into cheese. What was it called? It's
There's also a great new vegan cheese that actually melts, and it's called Earth Island. It's by Follow Your Heart, the company as well. So for people who are looking for a good cheese alternative for things that that require kind of a melting, gooey consistency as well. So those are some of the things that you make, and they go over well. Have you actually fed this food to some of your meat-eating friends?
Oh, for sure, yes. We if you go into other cultures' foods as well, you could have an Indian feast, a vegetarian Indian feast for Thanksgiving, and you could have people over, and they'll think they've just died and gone to heaven if you have really great Indian food like chapatis and sabji and rice and basmati rice and all that kind of thing. And I mean, you go to Greece, you can have Greek food and be vegetarian. You can have Chinese food, Japanese food, anything, and still be vegetarian or even vegan and please all kinds of people. The Buddhist vegetarian restaurants, they like to emulate food using tofu and TVP and that kind of thing to create the illusion that you're eating a meat. But I don't even think that's necessary as such. There's so many beautiful foods on the planet and so many wonderful spices. Why does it have to revolve around meat and potatoes like you're an Irish refugee? I mean, it's ridiculous.
I think that for a lot of people eating like Buddhist vegetarian foods, that it's gone beyond, it goes beyond sort of people seeking meat analogs. I think sometimes people are just like that chewy consistency, and whether or not it's called duck is kind of irrelevant. But Greg, I wanted to thank you for being on the show, and we're going to quickly close. We've come to the end of the hour. I wanted to apologize. We weren't able to get Adam on. We're going to get him on next week. I think he'll be a good fit with the show that we're doing on globalization and factory farming. We're going to have a representative from the World Watch Institute, which is an amazing organization. They just put out a fantastic overview of factory farming and its impacts on the so-called developing world and the meat industry pushing into these countries and selling its products, and it's very, very detrimental techniques. So we are going to have Adam on hopefully next week. We'll have somebody on from the World Watch Institute talking about globalization. Thanks, Lamia, for tacking this kind of impromptu show.
Thanks, Lamia.
Carl, for bringing the music. I want to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving or a happy boycotted Thanksgiving. And stay tuned for Roadrunner and come back next week for Animal Voices.